And now it is actually my pleasure to introduce Courtney Hemphill, partner and technical lead at Carbon 5, our supporters this evening, to welcome our speakers. Please welcome Courtney.
Thank you. Hello, and welcome to tonight's program at Inform at the Commonwealth Club, Redesigning with Tristan Walker and John Maeda. I'm Courtney Hemphill. As mentioned, I'm a partner and technical lead at Carbon 5, and we're a digital product strategy firm. And we work with clients to create exceptional products, build growing teams, and to help them bring their vision to reality. And part of my job over the years has actually been to work closely with our clients and our teams and many of the talented founders and transformative organizations to really redefine our approach to product design. We believe that delivering working software early and often to real users allows for a continuous learning cycle. And from that, we feel that we can evolve beyond the obvious solutions and we can emerge with a better design. So we have foundations in the agile software development movement. We value communication. We value simplicity, feedback, courage, and respect. And all of these are really an ideal complement to user-centered design, to lean product strategies, and it's the fundamental core of great teams. So we share a belief that designing products and services that deliver real impact requires deep collaboration across different teams, representing diverse thinking and coming from a wide variety of background and skills. Inform and the Commonwealth Club, they bring so many important issues and speakers to a broad spectrum of Bay Area national audiences in a truly innovative way. So I'm pleased to introduce tonight's speaker, Tristan Walker, founder and CEO of Walker & Company Brands, makers of the Bevel Shave System and Trimmer, and the founder and chairman of Code 2040, and our moderator for this evening, John Maeda, global head of computational design and inclusion at Automattic and the author of the annual Design and Tech Report. So tonight's panel is going to be an inspiring conversation as Tristan and John will be discussing how businesses like Walker & Company are finding success in redefining product design by making products that are both visually appealing and highly effective. So please welcome Tristan and John.
Oh, good to
hello. This is awesome.
Sorry. The happy people.
Oh, so far.
I'm an overjoyed people. I know that's not correct. But when I was invited to get to interview Tristan, I was like, yeah, I'll do that 10 times, 20 times. And so I'm perhaps the happiest person here. Sorry, Tristan, I had a moment. I've been taking notes. You know, I've been taking notes about what do I want to ask Tristan on stage. I had a moment listening to Courtney and her introduction. That was a nice moment because the button, which button did you pick?
Rams.
Oh, excellent. Dieter Rams. I picked Muriel Cooper, who was the person that I met in 1987 who told me to leave MIT and go to art school. There she was awesome. On the table.
That's awesome.
I was like, whoa, Muriel, what you doing here?
Good karma.
And I was thinking about Carbon 5 and Courtney being a creative and technical lead, the combo. See that combo, the Reese's peanut butter chocolate, you know, peanut butter, rare combination. And when you think of Tristan, or when I think of Tristan, I think of him as someone who has so many parts that are integrating together to form a different kind of founder of a different kind of company. And that's exciting.
Thank you.
And Tristan, I've been like reading up about you in different ways, all positive, of course. But if there's one thing I learned from my fine time at Kleiner Perkins was the idea of a lightning round to start off.
Okay.
And I didn't actually give you the questions beforehand to prepare you, but so I apologize in advance. But I was like, what kind of lightning round could I do? And so I'm going to ask Tristan six questions just to give him a easy
Christ.
Ones. Right. And you just have to answer with the one that you think is you.
Okay.
Stanford, ready? And I call this starting with food and getting nerdy. Okay. First question. Blueberries or strawberries?
Strawberries.
Oh, fast.
Easy.
Okay, there we go. Soylent 8-ounce or Starbucks venti latte?
Ooh. Starbucks venti latte.
Ah, okay. Go. Tough. I know that was tough for different reasons. Okay. Okay, next one. Original iPhone or iPhone 6?
Original iPhone every day.
Though. Oh, yeah. That iPhone 6 falls out of your hand all the time. Designed to break your glass. Okay, next one. Iron Man or Black Panther?
Black Panther.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Cadillac or BMW?
BMW. That's easy.
That was fast. Just closed source or open source?
That's unfair.
I know.
That is unfair.
We'll leave it at that. So that's a little bit of Tristan. So to start with food and getting nerdy. Now we're going to go into how I noticed how, well, I'm sure all of you, when you had that moment when you got to talk to each other, and there was that sort of Seinfeld moment of no friendship for you. You know, you have to stop. But you had like, oh my gosh, I like this person. I want to hang out and talk with them, you know? And it's because you find different things that are kind of similar, not the same, and it feels really good. And I know that when I met Tristan, I just went, wow, like, oh, interesting background. And as I began to dig in closer to your background, I thought, oh, I feel some similarities. And so I pulled out some similarities between me and Tristan. First one is we both have business school in us. You have the better business school in you, of course. But a lot of people come up to me and always say, is business school really worth it, John? Mm-hmm. Is it really worth it? Should I get an MBA? And is it worth it? What do you say to them?
100%. You know, first of all, it costs like $200,000. And I tell a lot of folks I would have paid 3x, you know, for the education and the opportunity that I've gotten. I'm very thankful and blessed by the opportunity. So there are a couple reasons why I think business school was uniquely beneficial for me. Number one, it taught me that Silicon Valley existed, right? You know, prior to my applying to business school, I worked on Wall Street. I had no idea about this place. I thought Silicon Valley was a place where semiconductors got made. They got better over time. That's all I knew about this place. I hated Wall Street so much that I said I want to get as far away from this place as literally and figuratively as possible. Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, there's a school called Stanford. They're well known for entrepreneurship. Let me apply and let me try it. Fortunately, I got in. And the thing that is unique about Stanford, and I can't speak about any other business school, so you have to take what I say with a grain of salt. The thing that's so beautiful about Stanford Business School is not Stanford Business School, it's Stanford Law School, Stanford Medical School, Stanford Design School, among other things, and they're all across the street from one another. So I had the beautiful, amazing opportunity to just literally walk across the street and speak to folks who are the best in their field in every single category. And it really taught me about the power of collaboration to actually affect major change in the world. And it made me understand why Stanford specifically was so special. And secondly, you know, I have to give Stanford Business School some credit here. It fundamentally changed my life. I think business school in general, a lot of folks, particularly in Silicon Valley and tech, will say, no, you don't need business school. And I think that that's BS for a multitude of reasons. But most particularly, what I got to learn is what other folks did wrong, right? So that I knew that if I had to go through those same experiences, I wouldn't have to go through those same things, right? And I think that was worth every single penny that I could have mustered.
And when you think of, you work with a lot of people, like engineers, creatives, et cetera. When you have an engineer come up to you and say, should I go to business school, what do you tell them?
So my answer is the same for anyone else. You got to know exactly what you want to get out of business school, right? If you're asking that question, you probably shouldn't go. Right? I knew exactly what I wanted to get out of business school. I knew I wanted to start a company afterwards. I knew I didn't want to make the same mistakes that other folks and luminaries made, right? I knew I wanted to learn. I didn't know what I wanted to do, right? So what business school afforded me was that opportunity and time to really figure out the thing that was meaningful to me outside of just entrepreneurship itself. Like, what tangibly did I actually want to execute against? And it was, for that reason, the best decision that I ever made. And I ensure that anyone who actually inquires about business schools knows definitively what they want to do, because $200,000 is a lot of money to pay for something that you don't know what you want to get out of it. Right?
When you think about it, I'm going to release hover here because it's a question that I get asked the most often is business school. I'm so glad you have all the right answers for it. So I'm like a creative person, and like, whenever I go to a meeting, I don't understand what the business people are talking about. Yeah. And I'm thinking of going to business school. What do you say to that person?
Well, the first thing is a lot of the business people don't know what the business people are talking about, right? So, like, so that's number one. I think we just got to kind of level set and table stakes. But, you know, the best business schools are the ones that are incredibly diverse. They're going to get the business folks. They're going to get the creatives. They're going to get the politicians. They're going to get the not-for-profit folks, mm-hmm. right? And again, when you combine it with the other schools that are on campus, that's what creates the greatest opportunity for you, mm-hmm. right? So what I say for folks is, you know, like, you got to understand what you want to get out of it, right? Mm-hmm. Because certain schools are unique for certain things, right? If you know you want to stay in finance, there are certain schools for that. If you know you want to be entrepreneurial, there are certain schools for that, right? So just really understand that and kind of pick right.
Wow, got the final answer there. So know what you want, okay? And don't forget that you're going for the ecosystem around it.
Yeah, totally. And I think even more important, and I speak to a lot of folks that think they know what they want to do, but they really don't, right? And I kind of have rationalized this over the past few years. Up until business school, you know, I would kind of live my life according to what other folks believed that I should do, right? You know, I wanted to work on Wall Street because it seemed like the right thing to do, and folks would push me in that direction. You know, I wanted to be an athlete because it felt like the right thing to do. But it wasn't until kind of after I kind of went through the business school program and knew I wanted to start my own company, et cetera, that I had to think, you know what? I can't care what people think about me, right, and the things that I want to do. I need to fundamentally do the things that I fundamentally believe need to be built, drive my own personal ambition, and not have any regard for what folks believe that I should be doing, right? So that was, like, for me, the most freeing realization, and I think the folks that succeed in business school are the folks that come to that realization a lot sooner than later.
That keyword, people who succeed in business school, I just want to pause on for a second. Yes, Stanford Business School is awesome, and all these schools are awesome, but all of them don't succeed. Mm-hmm. And when you forget that, and you notice that we're with someone who went through that program and made the investment, and is one of the few that are succeeding, is phenomenal. Can we just give some applause for Tristan? Come on. I'm sorry. He makes it look so easy, but not easy at all. Okay, finally know how to answer that question. Second question. So second thing we share in common is we were both in Helena Price's Techies Project.
Yes.
I when it came out, I was like, oh, look, there's Tristan there too. Like, oh, we did it together. Well, we weren't there together, but it all happened that way. When she reached out to you, why did you decide to be a part of it?
Yeah. So for folks who aren't familiar with it, the Techies Project is a really fantastic project led by Helena. She's a fantastic photographer. She wanted to profile a lot of the kind of great folks of color in technology and tell their stories in a unique and authentic way. You know, whenever that happens, I get very excited about it, right? Because I think that there's an important story to tell there. Right. When you consider at least folks of color, I fundamentally believe this to be true, particularly in the context of my own personal company. You know, folks of color, at least in this country, are kind of the cultural arbiters for the entire globe. Right. If you think about all culture, I fundamentally believe all global culture is led by American culture, which is led by Black, Latino, Asian culture in the U.S. Right. So really to understand how the producers, right, within this demographic group that happens to be the greatest consumer demographic group in the world, like understanding how they're producing, understanding how they're fundamentally changing the world and how we look at it, it's incredibly important, right? And when you kind of consider kind of the power shift happening in this country, a lot of which kind of is translating from like D.C. to Silicon Valley, and having these arbiters of culture who are producers kind of building great things for the world, you know, those are stories that deserve to be told. Those are stories that deserve to be evangelized, that are the stories that really deserve kind of everyone's reading. So, you know, whenever I get that opportunity to kind of participate, I drop everything else and ensure that I'm being supportive.
I mean, when I saw you, I was like, oh, he's so busy, but he's in there. And it was so unique because it really represents every type of person out there. Like, I think I was in there because I'm like an older person. But I think that, you know, whether representing the LGBTQ population, more women engineers, it was older. Yeah, it was just this wonderful. I was like, wow, this is America.
Yeah, it's incredibly important. And at least when I fundamentally kind of think about our production and our influence, et cetera, you know, the reason why it's so important that these stories get told is because I fundamentally believe that the folks that are creating, folks of color that are creating here, if we continue to support them, it's the greatest economic opportunity of my lifetime, whether that be for-profit or not-for-profit, and America's competitiveness, right? So whatever I can do for a country that believes so deeply in its hope and, like, opportunity, if we're not evangelizing that, then we're doing a disservice to this country.
And I wasn't asked to advertise this project, by the way. It's just something I read all the time because there's so many interviews in there and like, huh, I never saw the world that way. Or so if you have a moment anytime or, you know, we have all these moments where we're like standing in line waiting for something, Techies Project, read a different interview by a different person and you'll start thinking differently because our whole world is bombarded with this image of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
With that HBO TV show that's funny and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But you start thinking maybe that's the right way, even though you make fun of it. So yeah. That's a big bias change for Techies Project. So it's evergreen. Ah, third thing we have in common, venture capital world.
Oh, man.
You were in a venture capital. You were hanging out in VC.
Indeed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell us about what that's like,
yeah,
Kristen.
Absolutely. So again, I'm so incredibly blessed and fortunate to have a lot of the opportunities that I've had. So, you know, I worked at a company called Foursquare. I worked there for about 3 years. You know, I was one of the earliest employees. I got to, you know, build the type of company that I always wanted to build, right? A company that folks were inspired to support, that was fundamentally changing the world. And at the end of the 3 years, I felt there were other ambitious things that needed building, right? And I wanted the opportunity to do that. So one of our board members, Ben Horowitz, said, come join us for 9 months. Figure out what you want to do, and we'll pay you to do it. To this day, don't tell my team, it's one of the best jobs I've ever had because I got paid to think of ideas every day, which is actually crazy.
Your team's right here. Watch out.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's like I can't hide from it. So the story goes, I like to say, you know, I spent all 9 months there because they were paying me to do it, but I spent the first 7 months of my time there wasting their time, right? So what does that mean? You know, I was trying to chase the most ambitious thing that I could ever build. Like I wanted to build a bank, fix childhood obesity, that sort of thing. And it was the kind of most transformative, one of the most transformative periods of my life because I realized in that if I'm going to dedicate the next like 20, 30, 40 years of my life to anything, I wanted to fundamentally feel like I was the best person in the world to solve that thing, right? And it took my having to be at a venture capital firm to really understand that. You know, a lot of venture capitalists, you know, they'll see hundreds or thousands of pitches every single year. And one thing that you see is lots of sameness. Right? There are a lot of folks just chasing the same things. And the best venture capitalists, Andreessen Horowitz being one of them, you start to realize that the best venture capitalists are the ones that chase the things that are completely counterintuitive, right? The bad ideas, right? You know, if you invest in the bad ideas, right, those tend to be the good ones. So, you know, the examples that we always give are like the Airbnbs and the Ubers, et cetera. Like, who would have ever thought that, you know, strangers would have rented out their own rooms to other strangers and charge money for that? Like, that is completely crazy, and that's a terrible idea as of like 10 years ago, right? And these guys have created like $30 billion of value in that bad idea. So it took my having been there for about 9 months to realize that I probably should be chasing the bad ideas, right? And for a while, I always tried to chase the good ones. And the challenge in that is if everyone else chases the good ideas, there's not much value to create, right? So it was, again, transformative in so much as my really believing and understanding that if I wanted to kind of create the step function change and like affect kind of society in ways that are incredibly ambitious, chase the bad ideas.
I want to hover here for a second because I'm recently out of the venture capital world into a new world.
Congratulations.
It's very interesting. And one thing that strikes me is I remember when I entered it, people kept saying to me, oh, John, you don't want to hang out with venture capitalists. They're bad people. And I would tell them, well, I know a lot of bad artists. You just don't want to be near them. They're dangerous.
Yeah.
So because I found there are good venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about your experiences with working with good venture capitalists and what they taught you before you were going to jump in to make a company? What did you notice about what the good venture capitalists were doing with their entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so it's interesting that you actually worded it that way. I mean, look, I mean, there's nothing special about there being venture capitalists, right? Like, they're just good people, right? And the one thing that I was very thankful for, at least in my time there, is that I had folks that were willing to tell me the truth. You know, prior to my going there, you know, I had a lot of venture capitalists that would say, you know, Tristan, you can start a sock company. I'm in. Like, just tell me, right? Like, I'll give you all this, like, all this money to do it. And it's fascinating. Once I finally gave them the idea that I wanted to do, they were like, eh, I don't know about that, right? Like, I'm not sure I support that as much. And it was an incredible eye-opening experience where I actually learned that it's not necessarily the case that the folks on the other side of the table are smarter than I am, right? Perhaps they just don't have the context that I have, right? And there's a beauty and, like, an importance in that, right? So when I think about it, I don't think about title of venture capitalist when I think about folks on the other side of the table. I think, are you willing to acquire the context that I have to understand what we're actually building, right? Mm. And fortunately, at Andreessen Horowitz, I have folks that are willing to tell me that truth and acquire that context.
I think what's an important lesson that I take away from just listening to you in these initial minutes, and I love how we have an old-fashioned counter. There's no iPad. An actual binder with numbers on it. Crazy. But when you think about biases, unconscious mm-hmm. bias, I think there's unconscious bias towards people with money.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they're all bad people. I saw it on TV. Mm-hmm. They were doing bad things. Mm-hmm. And I think that for entrepreneurs, you can't help but have that bias of having seen it on TV. Yeah. So at what point were you able to get over your own bias against the money people to realize that they were actually going to be partners with you?
So first of all, I have no bias against money people because I want to be a money person, right? I've had every desire in the world, at least given my background. I've come from pretty humble beginnings. And, you know, I have every goal in the world to be as wealthy as possible as quickly as possible so I can affect the change that I seek, right? So that's first and foremost. I don't have any problems with wealthy folks, right? I have problems with wealthy folks that aren't willing to acquire the context to really understand how to change the world, I should say. So at least for me, right, like, it just really boiled down to, at least in Silicon Valley, there are rich folks that don't care, and there are rich folks who do care. So at least in the 32 years of my life, you know, I've learned a lot about myself, right? Like, what's important, how I prioritize the things that are important to me, et cetera. And over the past year or so, you know, I've had a few transformative experiences to speak to some of this. I live my life very simply now. I have six values that matter. Right, personal values that also translate to my company, but they're personal values of mine. It's courage, inspiration, respect, judgment, wellness, and loyalty. Right, full stop. Every single decision I make, all the folks that I hang out with, the folks that I seek advice from, are folks that share those values. Right. So for me, it's a bit of a moot kind of like point in question because I only try to involve myself with folks that share my personal values. That doesn't necessarily mean that we share the same views of the world, right? But we have the same core personal values, and I try to not make time for anything else.
Wow, he's optimized. I've hung out with so many bad people in my life by not having that six checklist. I'm like, hi, let's be friends. Oh, that hurt, you know. Okay, maybe I could have, like, done more in my life. So when we talk about, but I want to hover again on venture capital, because one thing that I didn't realize is how useful venture capital money is.
Touche.
I mean, here you are, you're making your company, and you're just so busy, and the margins are like this, and the most you can grow is this, and the most you can dream is like this, and venture capital money changes that game.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, quite literally, it does. In order to start the company that I, you know, started, it would take $2 million to start it, right? Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You just got to raise the money in order to get folks to know that you exist, right? So that's number one. And then I'd say number two, it's both a gift and a curse, right? Because the minute you take money, there's a growth imperative that they have that might be completely different from your own, right? You know, I have every ambition in the world to build a company that's still around 150 years from now, right? You compare that with a lot of venture capitalists that need to see a 10x return inside of 10 years. Like, how do you actually kind of combat that? So this goes back to the kind of personal values, right? Like, I need to make sure that every single investor, board member, employee, et cetera, shares my own personal values to that ambition for 150 years from now. Otherwise, we're doomed, right? So venture capital is the greatest thing in the world and the worst thing in the world, depending on who you work with.
That who you work with and Tristan's six checklist, I wish I wrote it down, but I hope someone wrote that down. Good combination of things. Okay, very effective. Now we're going to go into the topic of this gathering here, design, because I know you're passionate about
Very
it.
Much so.
Your products, like, they're designed. They feel like design. They aspire to even more design. As I watch you on Twitter, and I just found out that Tristan, that's actually him on Twitter, like firing off tweets.
All the time. I apologize.
I thought he had like an extra person or maybe a robotic Tristan next to him doing
Definitely
this or something.
Not.
But you're talking to the entire planet. And they're saying to you things like, oh my gosh, I love Bevel. I love this. And you're like, yeah. How do you do that? But you're really connected to your customers. And you can feel how excited they are that you're designing something for their unique needs that was overlooked.
Sure.
So first of all, when people tell you your design is really excellent, what is that design? Like what exactly is design in your world, in your company's view?
Yeah. That's an interesting question.
You're wearing Adidas ROMs. Back,
I am.
So.
You know, the reason why it's like so funny and ironic, because like, you know, I was thinking about this on the way here, because you had tweeted out today some like sample questions. So I'm like looking at his Twitter account. I'm like, oh, what should I prepare? And one of them was like, you know, how do we define design or something? And
I
the
left
irony
it at the bottom.
Yeah. The irony is like I was thinking about my coffee table. And you know, everyone has coffee table books and that sort of thing. And I just ordered one 2 weeks ago. It just got delivered a couple days ago. And the one that sits atop of my coffee table, the title is Defining Design. And I'm like, damn, I should have read it before I started this one. And I think you wrote the foreword or something like that, didn't you? Yeah, so like, it's absolutely hilarious. But anyway, so here's how I think about it. I think about this quite a bit, and I hope I don't butcher it, but it matters to me. When I think about design, I think about something very simply. I think about kind of like beautiful, empathetic, like, solutions to a problem, right? And I think about, like, my own kind of personal inspirations. Funny enough, I'd never told you, I read your, like, simplicity book, and that actually inspired me quite a bit about 4 or 5 years ago. Anyway, it's a very tearful moment. my hero. So the thing about beautiful, empathetic design, I think about a lot about my own kind of inspirations, right? And this goes all the way back to like Dutch painters, like the Vermeers, the Rembrandts, et cetera. And even more recently, you know, I get really excited about like photography, street photography, right? So you have the Bruce Davidsons, the Gordon Parks, right? The Vivian Myers of the world. And these are folks in different centuries, different genres of art and design, et cetera. And there's one thing that kind of like binds them all together, right? And it's like they're finding beauty in like mundane things, right? Like the mundane is incredibly beautiful. And it's not only that they find beauty in that mundane, right? They give it dignity, right? And hope and inspiration. Mm. So when we think about at least Bevel, which is the first flagship brand under Walker & Company, so for folks who aren't aware, you know, Bevel is the first and only shaving system designed specifically for folks with coarse curly hair prone to irritation, razor bumps, et cetera. We've eradicated the issue. A problem that's been around for around 100 years, right? Up to 80% of black men and women have it, 30% of everyone else. So you take something as mundane and boring as shaving, right? And kind of we look at the stories that we get from our customers, right? The single mom who's teaching her son how to shave, right? That's my story. You know, the gentleman in the army that has to shave every day with inferior products, prone to razor bumps, and affects his performance in the field. The gentleman working on Wall Street that gets ridiculed for donning a beard to work out of fear of using some of the mass market products. That's a very mundane story. And what Bevel's allowed and provided is dignity in our own kind of personal design. That's not only aesthetic, right? It's experiential, right? We want our folks to feel like first-class citizens in a world where at retail they feel second-class, right? So everything from not only the note that folks get from us every single time they purchase that's handwritten by me to the 2.5 seconds it takes to lift the top of like lid from the bottom, right, and building that anticipation for what's beneath. Like, we're very thoughtful about that stuff. And, you know, I can get really verbose about this stuff because I care quite a bit. You know, Johnny Ive at Apple said something that stuck with me for a while at a conference a couple of years ago. He said, you know, consumers can discern care for a product as much as they can discern carelessness for it, right? It was like such a uniquely interesting kind of statement to make, right? Like folks noticed the 2.5 second lift. Like folks noticed the handwritten penmanship, right? Like folks noticed the fact that we'll do like video one-on-one interviews with folks when they shave, knowing it doesn't scale, but knowing that it's important, right? So the reason I think we have so many customers that love us from, you know, in our design and our experience, et cetera, because we see that beauty in the mundane and we're willing to tell those stories in a way that gives it dignity, right? And I'm very thankful for the opportunity to do it and hopefully, you know, it continues in that stead.
You know, you made me think just now about design, and I'm having my own sort of moment now by just joining Automatic, and I've been happiness engineering,
yeah,
which is our word for customer support, yeah. But it's more, I mean, it's like amazing. And just working with the happiness engineers, I realize how much happiness they bring,
yeah,
to people making this site or whatever, changing this whatever. And I grew up in a tofu store in Seattle, and we had customers. My mom, they would come not for the tofu, for my mom, because she was awesome.
Yeah.
But that customer support linkage we lose in companies, mm-hmm, and engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And you made me think about how part of your design ethos or philosophy is likely fueled by being on Twitter, mm-hmm, and hearing the good with the bad. I'll see you react to the bad with the same energy that you do with the good. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, you can feel their dignity changing by your products, mm-hmm, and you want to fight harder.
Of course, 100%. It's like, we're in a world that is growing more devoid of empathy. And that sucks, right? It shouldn't be that way. Right? So I want to ensure that everything that we do, every single interaction we have with our customers, every single interaction we have with potential customers, every single interaction we have with canceled customers, right, really brings empathy to the forefront, right? And if we don't do that, we fail. It's really that simple.
I remember when we were in Aspen for a design thing together, and I was really happy when you were trying to help the audience understand that design isn't just about pretty things.
Mm-hmm.
It impacts business, impacts your business.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that further?
Yeah, no, totally. So it's interesting. So I kind of think about this idea of beautiful, empathetic solutions. Like, what does that mean in the world where you build companies? Right, so like, what's a potential problem that needs a solution? Right, so one thing that we talk a lot about is even just the diversity of our company. Right, we have a company in Silicon Valley, which is a bit weird that like we're majority minority, majority woman. The majority of my leadership is women of color. Like, that's different and unique and weird. It shouldn't be, but it is. Right, and we always knew a couple of things. Number one, in order to build a company that matters in the space that we're in, the diversity of our employee base needs to reflect the diversity of our consumer base, right? So number one, let's solve that problem by ensuring that happens. So how do you do that, right? I just came from another talk at another technology company, and they asked me similar questions around diversity inclusion and how it's possible that like you guys are majority minority and we're not. And I'm like, it's very easy. Like, it's very, very simple. And we kind of approach this with empathy very much in the same way. It all starts with values, 100%, right? A few folks from my team are here now, and perhaps they can kind of tell you, anytime anyone says kind of the words culture fit, I get disgusted, and I kind of want to throw up, right? The reason is, no one ever defines it, right? Like, when you say culture fit, it's like, this person made me laugh. I play golf with this person. That's a very selfish thing, right? There's no empathy and selflessness in that, right? So 2 weeks even before I found got my first round of funding, I wrote down those six values, the courage all the way to loyalty, right? And I defined every single one. Why is that important? Now when we interview folks, we'll ask leading questions to get at one's inspiration, courage, respect, judgment, wellness, loyalty, right? When we give your semi-annual reviews, you're rated against your goal attainment, but also your adherence to the values that we have at the company. You know, why does that matter? Because we operate the same way when I'm in the room or outside of it, right? And that's selfless, at least in my opinion. So we've taken a very big problem that a lot of folks have, and we've solved it through empathy. And notice something about every single one of those values. right? It's not male, it's not female, it's not Black, Latino, Asian, it's not old, it's not young. And you look at a lot of the other companies that exist out there, it's like biased action, right? We're going to kill our competitors, right? Like, no, that doesn't resonate with everyone. Like, everyone wants to be courageous. Everyone wants to be inspired, right? Folks want to kind of be treated with respect. And I think in our definition of those things, by definition, we are practicing our own empathy. So it should be no different in our product development as it is in our hiring.
This is like one of those desserts where you just want to enjoy it more. Just don't want to like mess it up or anything, you know? Because this, when you said the word culture fit, that word to me also signals just the easy feeling you can have, but you just don't have to justify it.
It's lazy.
And then it begins to propagate a notion that, well, they're like us and they're not like us and we're better than them. Yeah. And it's just so vague.
Yeah. Very much so. I hate it.
Yeah.
I hate it so much.
Ooh, I like, I'm going to hate that word from now on. Now.
Good.
watch out. Okay. So, so why is it, well, at least I've seen this, maybe you've seen it differently, but why is it that most creative people out there, creative people, traditionally trained creative people, make a face when they hear the word business? Like, business, you know? You know, I'm not sure if you've ever seen that face before, yeah. But I've seen it a lot. Do you ever see that face at all? Or maybe in your past lives or no?
Well, at least for me, I see a hell of a lot less of it. I actually wanted to ask you that same question, but I'll answer first and I'll put it back on you.
Yeah, we can do that.
Right? So I think the reason why I haven't seen as much of it is because, like, I don't think I'm a business person. I think I'm a creative person that appreciates business, right? Like, I think there's too much us versus them, and there are plenty of folks in the world that can appreciate both. Right? Like folks like you, like folks like me, et cetera. And I think the more and more we can appreciate the fact that it doesn't have to be us versus them, like that opens up opportunities for more empathy, more creation, more brilliance, more genius, right? So I've never really had to deal with that as much because I try to speak my language as creatives do, right? And again, by definition, that is empathy, right? So I never understood why folks kind of cringe and make that face, because to me, they're one and the same. Like, it's hard to be a creative without an appreciation for business because you're going to create something that no one could benefit from, right? The definition of being a creative is creating value, right? But then someone needs to extract that value, right, to the benefit of others. You know, one of the best lessons that I learned, not necessarily about this, but it's tangentially related. You know, I was 20 years old, and I was working on Wall Street, hating my life, right? And there's one gentleman. His name was Bill Lighton. He was a managing director on Wall Street, one of the most successful, like, Black managing directors ever. He said, "Tristan, sit down." And I was like, "All right, great, thank you." And he said, "I have the formula for life," right? And I was like, "All right, awesome, hit me with it." And he said, "You know, Tristan, you want to spend the first third of your life learning, the second third of your life earning, and the last third returning," right? And I thought that was unique. You know, here's a guy who left Yale when he was 20. He started to work on Wall Street. The day he turned 40, he quit. He was super successful, didn't have to, making millions of dollars. And then now he's doing straight up philanthropy. The reason he ordered it in that way, he said too many people try and put the return thing before the earn thing, which prevents them from scaling their return and impact, right? And it's just an interesting thing for me to hear. So when I kind of thought about my own career, it's like, how do I shorten the earn thing so I can maximize the return thing? And if you're a creative that fundamentally wants to change the world, if you kind of poo-poo business, right, like you're going to minimize your impact. And I never wanted to fall victim to that.
Mm. Well, you know, most people don't, you know, it's funny, just like yesterday I was talking with someone about a HyperCard, and they're like, HyperCard? I'm like, oh my gosh, you don't know HyperCard. and I realized that many people don't remember there was a time when Apple sucked. It was like, Apple? Oh, give me a break.
He, you know, said it, like, I didn't.
There was that time where Apple, you know, Apple. And the reason why it's important is that because Steve Jobs version one kept making these super over-designed objects that cost too much. Yeah. that nobody would want to pay for because they could buy something that was 10 times faster and half the price. So what a dumb idea.
Yeah.
Until he brought in Tim Cook, who brought the whole logistics science to reduce the actual cost of an Apple design thing to be able to have huge margins to invest in design. So that is business thinking.
Well, I mean, it's just as beautiful as the aesthetic part of it, right? Like the fact that you can make something so beautiful at half the cost, like why isn't that beautiful? That's the sexiest thing on the planet to me, right? Like that is awesome. Like by making it cheaper, you make it more accessible. That means that more folks can benefit from it. You scale your return and your impact, right? So sure, like creatives can poo-poo business and they can affect five people. I want to affect 5 billion.
And for anyone who is dealing with this dilemma in their own life or a friend dealing with that dilemma, let us remember that Tristan is wearing a Dieter Rams pin. Dieter Rams, known worldwide for being the sort of iconoclastic designer of appliances and things like that, and sort of like amazing, all tied to Bauhaus-style thinking. And Bauhaus is the temple of design, where pure thinking was allowed, but forgetting that the Bauhaus was a project of the German economic ministry as a way to compete nationally against the British, who in the 1800s formed a department of art and science to fund something called the Royal College of Art and the V&A Museum to make better wares in Britain because they were jealous of the French, because in the 1700s, the French were killing it.
That's awesome.
But it was all an economic play. But somehow it was forgotten that economic play
existed. That's important. It matters. It matters in a very big way. And all that I care about now is like, how do we just scale this impact in a way that it's truly significant?
So what tech company comes to mind when you think about design? In 2016, you think, oh, yeah, that tech company.
Only one?
Yeah.
Oh, 25 minutes? I still have 25 minutes to figure this out. Twitter.
Why?
The thing I appreciate so much about Jack Dorsey is that he's completely uncompromising. He knows what he believes the platform should be. There's power in the platform of communication. He wants to extract all the superfluous for the sake of its core benefit and connecting the world together in a unique way. He doesn't let the business interest kind of affect that line of thinking, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of one of the few technology companies, and look, you look at Apple now without Steve Jobs, Tim Cook running it, like it feels like a business as opposed to, you know, a company with real immense soul to it and real continued empathy. At least when I think about Twitter, at least as far as kind of Jack Dorsey's being at the helm, it still feels like there's soul, right? Like he's empathetic to the needs of its users. And there's something about that soul that just speaks to me, right? Like, you know, any company that designs to that soul and that empathy and the unique kind of latent needs of its consumers, right, is a pretty special thing. And it's incredibly simplistic. You know, one thing I tell a lot of folks, and it's probably the most taboo thing to say, particularly out here on the planet, you know, I think Twitter is one of those services that will never die, right? Even if it doesn't succeed as a business, it is so valuable to certainly to me and other folks, that it will become the most well-funded 501c3 like on the planet, right, if it did. And I'm not sure I can say that about very many other companies. And the second thing, I think about this in the context of my own company. You know, I think a lot about this. I'm 32 years old now, and I can't say matter-of-factly that I've had companies I was proud to support. There are a lot of great companies with great products, right? Apple, Tesla, all that stuff, right? But I can't say I'm proud to support those companies, right? And I feel like, you know, I kind of make this joke, and it's a very serious statement, but I kind of say it all the time. When my mom was growing up, you know, she had like Soul Train, right? And like Sofshin Carson and like stuff like that, where she's fundamentally proud to support those things. And when I look at this generation and future generations, at least in the context of Walker & Company, can we be that brand that folks are proud to support? I think the closest kind of company that kind of speaks to some of that, that I'm actually fundamentally proud to support, is Twitter.
I'm just laughing to myself because you mentioned your mom and Soul Train. I mean, my mom is like 82 years old, and she thought that buying Franklin Mint things was going to make him money someday.
That's awesome.
She has all these things from Franklin Mint, and she says, John, we can sell these. And mom, they're not worth anything. But I bring it up because that was a really good business.
Yeah, totally.
But it was a soulless business.
Yeah. Totally.
Because I did see you make the business face.
Yeah.
Business. Then you added, but soulful.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I'm pulling away from how we describe a great business, just listening to you, is that you want a business with a soul. Yeah. Like not this one that tricked my mother into thinking that this is how she was going to make up her retirement.
Yeah.
Seriously, she just thought I would, and it looked pretty good at the time.
Yeah.
But then you added the word empathy,
mm-hmm.
and I think you mentioned Twitter. I think, personally, the reason why you like Twitter is because you can stay in touch with your customers. It's a real-time way to keep the empathy in you alive.
Well, I loved Twitter before I even had customers, right? Before I even had a company, right? So the other word that I'd added in there is authenticity. Like, one thing that folks don't know about me, I mean, they see me on Twitter all the time, and they think I'm the most extroverted person on the planet. I'm incredibly introverted, like, incredibly introverted. What Twitter has allowed me to do is to scale my, like, voice to a lot more people, whether it's customers or not, right? And it allows me to continue to be my best self as long as I continue to kind of articulate the values that matter to me. And I can reach anyone, right? And I could touch anyone. And I could be authentic in that regard without necessarily having to kind of travel and be at a networking event, drinking with these groups of folks that I may or may not like, et cetera, right? But like that's to give someone like me voice, particularly when one might think that introversion is a flaw, right? Like Twitter showed me that it doesn't have to be. And that's why I'm so thankful for it.
Mm. I was going to ask a Facebook question, but that'd get controversial. I have another different question. Quick change of subject, but it could get dangerous. So is Walker & Co. a tech company?
Well, we're a health and beauty products company, and we leverage tech to completely disrupt the way people think about health and beauty products. You know, one question I get a lot is like, Tristan, why'd you leave tech? Right? All the time, at least once a week, I get that. And, you know, I started to kind of refine my answer best after kind of one particular event that happened to me a few months ago. You know, I was at this like USA Today event and on a panel, and afterwards, I had a gentleman walk up to me and he said, Tristan, you know, why'd you leave tech? And what happened next was funny, but like also guided the way that I think about my business. So I asked him, I was like, what shampoo do you use? And he said, Suave. And I was like, problem number one. So the second question that I asked him, I said, do you know who owns Suave? He said, no. I was like, okay. And I said, when was the last time Suave communicated with you? He's like, never, right? And I think about like a lot of the stuff that we do, right? Like, you know, you travel and don't want to go to TSA, like we'll ship blades to your destination for free. If it's your first time ever shaving, we'll do video one-on-one chats with you completely free, right? Like we do all these crazy things that do not scale truly to our kind of own customer benefit. Is that tech? If you kind of took away all the health and beauty stuff, I think so. Not only that, I think a lot of folks think about kind of the context of the company where it is right now. Right, we have a 150-year plan for this company, leveraging technology in continued innovative ways. Right, so our communication with those customers, our messaging to those customers. Right, if folks come to our website from Palo Alto, they probably should be seeing something different from folks who come from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. The tone of voice should probably be different. Right, we should be empathetic to kind of that locale, their needs, among other things. Right, so this goes to some of that empathy. You know, I think even about the products that we make. Right? You know, we're in an industry that's $500 billion built completely on the shoulders of subjectivity. Right? Why is it the fact that not everyone's unique physiological makeup is respected. Why is it the fact that my son has to use the same baby lotion as everyone else, right? When he has eczema, allergies, et cetera, right? Why is it the fact that, like, my wife has to use the same hair care products as anyone else? There's nothing more unique on the planet than an individual's physiological makeup, but this is the last industry on the planet that has not respected it, right? You need technology to fix that problem. I can't see any other way to do it. So a lot of folks kind of look at our company as Bevel. No, we're not a shaving company. We're a family of brands building very ambitious things to solve really important problems for people. But when I kind of think about our grandiose vision for Walker & Company, I want everybody on the planet to experience a Walker & Company brand. I want that brand that they experience in that category to be the last brand they ever feel they have to use. And the reason they're going to do that is because we're going to show them that the products that we that they're using on themselves work, and we're going to show them how much they work. Right? Stay tuned.
I'm glad I wasn't that suave man.
Yeah, me too.
Looking good, John.
This is meant to be interactive, and I hope you've been holding in your questions, because soon we'll have the chance to do questions, in roughly 5 minutes, actually. And if you have a question, please line up in the far aisle to your right, all the way against the wall. Point over there. Okay? And please remember to ask single one-part questions. You all know what that is, okay? Single one-part questions. Thank you. Okay? Because I know some of you don't. Okay. But it's America, so it may happen. The last question from me, then. Okay. So I think that because you're a quasi-hybrid person, multi, you know that there are generally two types of thinkers out there. There are the linear thinkers, linear execution-oriented thinkers, the convergent thinkers. And there are the non-linear, you know, Captain Jack, you know.
I know,
it's still difficult right now. But complex, creative, like, where are they going with this? Divergent. Two types of people. Which type of person does a CEO listen to the most?
Listen to the most?
Yeah. Which is that? Which population should the CEO of a high-growth startup listen to the most?
What do you think, Cass?
Oh, my gosh.
Who do I listen to? You think I listen to nonlinear? Well, who said that? You said that?
I think linear.
You think I appreciate linear people?
I appreciate linear.
All right, so I'll take the contrarian view. I think nonlinear. Okay, so particularly in the context of like the company we want to build, if we are to build a kind of 150-year-old company, for me to focus primarily on nonlinear versus linear thinking would be a failure, right? And I kind of say that through this experience. I get a lot of like press interviews, and a lot of folks will ask me, you know, what's your 5-year plan? That's always the hardest question for me to answer. Like, I always can answer the 150-year plan. I could always answer the 12-month plan, but I could never answer the 5-year plan. And the reason is, the 5-year plan is just a suite of like well-executed 12-month plans, right? You know, things change, businesses change, acts of God happen, right? Like, there's no way that kind of linear thinkers can think that far in advance, at least in my opinion. But you need those linear thinkers to guide your process, right? Guide your innovation. I'm an incredibly nonlinear person, right? Like, things come, I adapt, et cetera. You know, either to our company's benefit and to our demise. I don't know. We'll see. but I've been very blessed and fortunate to kind of surround myself with both linear and nonlinear kind of thinkers, right? You know, at least when I think about my own management, I try and anchor our team so far towards the extremes for the sake of innovation, knowing that we're never going to get there, but we're further right than center, right? And I need kind of like a lot of those nonlinear thinkers to continue to support me in that stead, to push us further right than center. But, you know, if I didn't have the linear thinkers there, then it'd just be straight chaos, right? And, you know, I reflect a lot on kind of my own personal leadership and what leader I've been as a kind of CEO of the company that I'm leading currently. And in my life, I've always been this like step function kind of guy, right? Like, I want to kind of benefit humanity 2, 5, 10, 100x, right? And it's really hard to manage people that way, right? It really is, because you can't assume that everyone's the same. And there are a lot of really fantastic gradual thinkers, right? So over the past like 6 to 12 months, the one thing that has fundamentally changed my leadership, my personhood, among other things, I like to think, all right, well, if I can improve 1.2% every single week for a year, a year later, I'm 2x better than I was the previous year. That's just the power of compounding, right? So the more gradual I am in my thinking, while still trying to kind of push our team to the extremes, has served me quite well. But the only way I'm able to do that in a way that's sane is to surround myself with both.
Both. And on the question of both, we have a question queued back there. Do we have a question? Yeah. Yeah. Please say your name and then... go for it.
Hi, I'm Carlo.
That's the boss.
That is the boss.
I'm the president of Inform. Thank you both for coming tonight. What problem do you think needs solving right now for tech? If you could start another company that either of you would start, what would it be?
You go first. He asked you the question.
I asked both of you at the same time, so you should answer at the same time.
One, two, three. What company needs to exist out there? Oh, wow. Well, at least for me, I'm very curious how to intersect technology people with business people and design people, because I think they live in three different worlds, and there are so few people who freely can go across. And if there aren't more people that can go across and translate, then we're not going to see a lot of growth. So a company I've thought of is able to do that. So I believe in that. Go ahead, Tristan.
Yeah,
I asked the question.
No, it's a great answer. One thing I care a lot about is being able to debate in a way that's constructive. Right? I think about a lot of what's been happening over the past year, particularly in politics, among other things. Like it's almost impossible for us to have kind of constructive conversations. Right? Like folks are so far right, so far left, that there's no middle anymore. Right? And therein lies the problem, right? So, like, what is the forum that needs to be created where we can, like, debate things in a way that's respectful of each other, that's based on fact, right? Among other things. And it's, I think it is very doable, kind of like with technology, but like, no one's trying to do it, perhaps because they just don't want to touch politics, but I think it's absolutely necessary in order for us to affect any semblance of change. Because if you're dealing too far in the extremes, nothing's ever going to happen. And it's my hope, not only not only for this region, but just for America, that someone builds this, right? A forum for debate that is incredibly constructive.
Hi, my name's Nate. What are some tools or frameworks that you like to use or that are your favorites to understand the needs of your user?
Yeah, it's a great question. One of my favorite questions.
Nice.
Actually. So I come from like the IDEO school of like kind of customer development. So any single product that we make, we need to make sure, first of all, we want to identify a problem need state, right? And fortunately, for our community, having kind of the majority of our customer or our employee base be folks of color, et cetera, incredibly diverse, we can identify those needs ourselves, right? Because we want to solve our own problems. But solving our own problems is not enough. We need to see if kind of these are problems that scale to kind of more broad populace. So the minute we kind of come up with these ideas, the first thing we do, we'll engage kind of in pure customer development mode, right? So we'll go, you know, for instance, we launched this electric trimmer. We fundamentally believe to be one of the world's most advanced trimmers. And the first thing that we did, we didn't do any designs for it, anything. We went to barbershops, videotaped folks, interviewed them, understood the difference between what they said they needed and what they actually needed. And the one thing I kind of learned throughout that entire process for design and to really get to empathetic, like really truly empathetic design, is to understand those latent needs, right? Like the difference between what people say and what they actually do. And it's so fascinating. Like we've never done a focus group. And like the reason that's so important, and I hate focus groups really for this reason, a lot of folks will say, like, yeah, I'll buy it. This is a great, great idea. And at the end of the focus group, if you say, all right, are you willing to buy it? They're like, yeah, no, right? But like throughout that whole process, you're really observing and understanding what they're saying and what they're doing. And that's where the true innovation happens. So everything starts with just go out and speak to people. and observe them and videotape them and understand that difference.
Next question, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Serene, and I'm going to break the rules, sorry. But I'm wondering if you could repeat your six values and also share how you identified them.
Sure. Courage, inspiration, respect, judgment, wellness, and loyalty. Courage, inspiration, respect, judgment, wellness, and loyalty. How did I identify them? That was the second part, right? These are my personal things that are important to me, right? When I think about kind of my prioritizing my own life, right? Like I think about three things. Number one, faith, family, work, in that order. Like those are the things that are kind of most important to me, and a lot of my own personal values are guided by my faith, right? And I think in particular, courage is always the first one, and I do that very deliberately. And there's this like beautiful quote that really speaks to it from Maya Angelou. She says, courage is the most important virtue because without courage, you can't practice any other virtue consistently, right? That's important, right? And it really helped guide the other things that kind of matter to me, and that stick-to-itiveness, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm always right, right? It just means that I have a kind of way of living that everyone else can expect, right? And if we disagree about what those virtues and values are, now we can have a discussion and a debate, right? But all too often, folks debate without really understanding the values on both sides of the table, and that's the problem. Yeah.
We have 5 people with questions.
That's it?
One moment. But I know the way time works. Sometimes someone at the end doesn't get the answer, ask their question, and I hate that. So we're going to use an optimization I've invented. So I'd like each of you to say your name, ask your question. I will take notes, and no more questions after that, so we can make sure we get them all answered. Is that okay? Okay, well, go ahead. Your name and your question?
Hey, my name is Paul Friedman. with your – one thing that struck me about your talk is like this 150-year plan. That's pretty bold long-term thinking. I was just wondering, like, there's specific things that can come up in that amount of time, some of which we know about, some of which we don't know about, like, for example, ecological crisis. Mm-hmm. Do you plan for that, or do you just kind of figure that you're going to keep doing what you do and then let other people focus on that?
Okay, Paul, thank you. Okay, hold, keep going. Next one.
I can't wait to answer that question.
My name's Gabrielle, and my question was very, very similar. It was, what's the 150-year plan?
Sure.
Oh, magic. Okay, thank you, Gabrielle. Go ahead.
Hey, my name's Mario, longtime fan, used to work at the Cape Horror Center, so admired your work through there and the marriage of business and impact. I guess my question is, you talk about the values that go into your company and into the products you produce. In your view, can the products also promote values, particularly the values that you put into them, mm-hmm. or are products separate from that or the function of them?
Good one.
Thank you. Next one.
Hi, my name is Alexi Gregg. My question is similar to Gabrielle and the previous gentleman. What's the point of the 150-year plan? Why? Like, why bother to make a company that lasts that long?
Sure.
Okay, got it. Keep going.
Hi, my name is Abdul Lee, and my question is pretty similar, except in your 150-year plan, my understanding is that you have this view for the suite of Walker & Co. products. How do you think about when is the right time to launch a specific product and how to kind of organize or prioritize those different products, whether it's the bevel blade or the trimmer or whatever is going to come next?
Mm-hmm. Double blade.
First, I want to applause for the people who stood up and asked questions, because you know, they wanted you to be here, and thank you for doing that.
It's a great process.
And I apologize for doing it this way, but it's optimized. I'm a Tim Cook fan, or all that stuff. Okay, it's MBA. So Paul's question, the 150-year plan, bold idea, but what if stuff happens, like the planet goes away? Have you planned for that?
Yeah,
what are you
going
to do?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I can't control what I can't control. You know, I have every faith in the world to know that, like, my faith will guide me through it. You know, some of the best advice I actually got was from a gentleman, Tyler Perry. He said, Tristan, you know, he realized his potential as an entrepreneur when he understood that the trials you go through and the blessings you receive are the exact same things, right? And one thing that's uniquely interesting about that is that those trials are just lessons, right? And those trials could be acts of God or otherwise. And the reason why it's so freeing for me is because we get this stuff all the time, right? Like, things happen that a lot of our employees think might be the end of the world. I don't, right? You just got to adapt. You got to be flexible. And I don't know what I can do about the end of the world. Like, it is what it is. But at least we would have chased that opportunity and hopefully build something that's, you know, 50 years old. That said, like, we can only kind of control the things that we can control. And for the things that we cannot, we just need to appreciate those trials when they come.
That's a bumper sticker. End the world's coming. Chase the opportunity. Okay, I'm going to collapse space-time with Gabrielle and Abdul. 150-year plan? So you've got this idea of a suite of products in the future. How do you figure out how to time those products? How do you prioritize them in this 150-year span?
Yeah, so, I mean, so our ideal and goal is to solve kind of every single... Well, no, why not? Solve every single kind of acute health and beauty problem that folks of color face and everyone over-indexes on, right? If we don't do it, who else will? Right? Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that we'll solve everyone, but we'll damn sure try to, right? So for as long as those needs happen, for as long as we practice empathy, for as long as we care about customers and humans, right? You know, it's a big reason why I started this company, because I fundamentally feel like I'm one of the best folks in the world to try this, right? I've been blessed with opportunity to try it. So why can't we dare to have the same ambition that the other folks that have that legacy have had?
And I think what's very important to note is that whenever you take an inclusive design approach, you discover that you're solving problems that you didn't know existed. Mm-hmm. So even for people who are not of color, your products are having an impact in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I fundamentally believe that I want everyone on the planet to experience a walking company brand, that'll take a long time. Mm.
We're going to channel Alexi with one more 150-year question, because you've clearly made an impact with 150 years. 150 years? So what's the point of a 150-year plan? Why bother? You didn't say that, of course, but I'm just sort of paraphrasing. Why bother?
Yeah, why not? You know, the thing that's most interesting about that whole thing is, like, that everybody asked it as if it's like a taboo thing. Why does it have to be? Right? Like, who questioned Procter & Gamble when they said the same thing? Or Johnson & Johnson, or the founders of Unilever? You know, something interesting that, like, is like Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, Unilever, and no one else.
Okay, I want to squeeze in this last one before your last 60 second. Okay. Mario's last question, because you stood in line. So where's Mario? This is for you. Mario?
He's right.
This is for you. So you've connected values with your company and your products. Mm-hmm. Can your products promote values?
100%. They have to. Otherwise, you're being inconsistent in your own personal values, right? So even I think about our own electric trimmer. A lot of the features we didn't have to build, but we had the courage to dare to create the world's most advanced trimmer. We need to ensure that when folks touched it, they felt inspired by the design and that we cared. They needed to know that we respected their needs, right? The fact that you go to your barber shop and he's using the same electric trimmers on everyone else's hair on your face is disgusting, right? So we create features to repel any of those impurities, that sort of thing, right? Like, we wanted to make sure that we were being loyal to those needs, among other things. So, like, those values don't only carry to the company, it carries in every single thing that we do, right? So if one were to come up with a brand or a product idea, it sure as hell better be courageous. It better be inspiring. It better respect the needs of our customers, right? Among other things, that helps.
Okay, this is the famous Inforum tradition to ask all the speakers this question. Here goes. Tristan Walker, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
All right. So it's going to sound a bit vague, but I'll kind of dig into it. It's to give us opportunity. And by us, I mean, like, certainly me as, like, a man of color, at least in Silicon Valley, having no awareness that this place was a thing. You know, Mitch Kapor says something, I don't know where this came from originally, and perhaps I'm embarrassed to not know this quote, but It's that genius is actually evenly distributed, but opportunity is not. That's a problem, right? Like, there's genius in this culture, right? There's, like, influence in this culture. And, you know, if you look at kind of a lot of things that we're doing, we're impacting the world in immeasurable ways. When you take this greatest consumer demographic on the planet and make them the greatest producer demographic on the planet, who's dared to kind of ask what can result from that? Think about it. Like, if you just kind of just take a few more steps in answering that question, that to me is not only the greatest economic opportunity of my lifetime, but is the greatest thing that America can actually do for its people and the world in general.
I think that captures the feeling. Let's first applause that feeling. Come on. And I think what underlies it all, from what I've learned by watching Tristan and living life a little bit, is that I understand that part of that 60-second vision is going to happen because you've attracted phenomenal people on your team.
Very lucky. Very lucky.
And when I sit here with your proud Lord of the Rings Fellowship people here, they're there to fight for this mission. I know Cassidy Blackwell. I mean, she was recently in design.blog. Thank
She's
you.
She's a gift to us.
The vision your team members bring. Every time I see you showing off your team on Twitter, these are my team. This is my team. Everybody, I want that team. And I want to acknowledge a team that I worked with at Kleiner Perkins, Aviv, Justin, and Jackie, who together with them, we did the design and tech report. They were my friendly young people who helped me figure things out in a venture capital firm, which I had no idea what venture capital was when I joined. I'm serious about that. And also to the global head of human resources, Lori McLeese over here at Automatic, who has brought me into an amazing Willy Wonka factory, 50-country global remote collaborative company to hope to bring more inclusion and creativity into it. So teamwork is everything, yeah? It's an amazing thing. And so I'm glad that you felt us teaming here on stage together. I felt it was a true honor to get to do that with you and with all of you. And I just want to close with another big round of applause for Tristan Walker.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay. All right. Cool.